Time for Wrigley's Spearmint.
The March of Time.
The makers of Wrigley's Spearmint Gum bring you the March of Time just as they present their own products for your enjoyment. This is an exciting year. What events it will bring forth, no man can tell. But come what may, you can depend upon the editors of Time to bring you their swift reenactment of these memorable events. So, too, you can always depend upon Wrigley's for quality and satisfaction.
Tonight, the editors of Time, the weekly news magazine, raise the curtain on their reenactment of the scenes which today have added one more dramatic page to history, to the March of Time.
Wednesday, May 27th, 1936. Today, broadcast from England and rebroadcast through American radio chains.
Jacques Bauer slowing up. Lord Astor's pay up has dropped back to fifth. Mahmoud is now ahead. He's three lengths ahead of Tarjac Bar. And he's lunged across the finish line with Jockey Smirk still up and hanging on for dear life. First place goes to Aga Khan's Mahmoud, the first grey horse to win the Derby since 1912.
Thus today from England comes news of the 157th Epsom Downs Derby, famed in the U.S. for the enormous publicity given holders of lucky Irish hospital sweepstakes tickets. News hawks today alight on Mrs. Gisela Knopf of Brooklyn, co-holder of a $150,000 winning ticket.
Last night I dreamed of a dove. It was flying fast like an airplane with its head down. When I woke up, the radio announcer was saying that Mahmoud, the horse I got the ticket for, is a gray horse. I says to my husband, he's unemployed at present, that means it's a dove. And it was, and we won.
But biggest profiteer on today's Epsom Downs victories is Aga Sultan Sir Mohammed Shah, His Highness the Aga Khan, spiritual leader of 60 million Muslims, who chalks up his $300,000 derby winnings today to add to his income of at least $3 million this year. Beaming over his good fortune, chortles he,
"It's quite a coincidence. Last year I won the derby during the King's Jubilee. And today, it is an especially appropriate victory, too. Today, it is on the occasion of the maiden sailing of that splendid big ship, the Queen Mary."
But declares Mrs. Oliver Harriman, president of the U.S. National Conference on Legalizing Lotteries,
"At least $6 million was sent to Ireland by Americans for the Epsom sweepstakes this year, and only $3 million came back in prizes. It is shocking to think that all this money is contributed by Americans for the support of Irish charities, when our own institutions are starving."
Today in faraway Tibet, high on the Himalaya Mountains, comes the end of a search which starts more than 2 years ago in the forbidden city of Lhasa, where in the room of the Crimson Potala Palace, the Dalai Lama, high priest of the Buddhist religion and ruler over 3 million Tibetans, lies on his deathbed, as Lama priests chant a strange dirge and turn huge prayer wheels.
"Lama priest, my time is at an end.
But you shall continue to live."
"Yes, in the person of an infant who will take his first breath as I take my last. He may be of high birth or low. You, Lama monks, will set out by caravan. Search the lakes of Tibet. In one, you will find mirrored the image of the home of your future, Dalai Lama."
For more than 2 years, giant prayer wheels spin in the forbidden city of Lhasa, while yellow-robed Buddhist monks search the lofty, snow-swept mountain passes of the Himalayas for the reincarnation of their Dalai Lama, search the lakes of Tibet for a reflection of the image. Then in the Hanyan district, a weary caravan stops at a hut on a wind-swept plain.
"Our search is ended. This is the house."
"Yes? Oh, holy Lama."
"Be not afraid.
You have an infant, Holy Mother."
"Yes, I do."
"A boy child."
"Yes."
What is his age?
Age? More than 2 years.
His exact age?
2 years, 5 months, 10 days.
The very day.
The exact day the Dalai Lama died.
Holy Mother, your boy may be the ruler of Tibet. You are blessed among us. Make him ready.
Ready? For what?
Your son is going on a long journey to the holy city of Lhasa. And if he is revealed to us as the one, your son will become the ruler of Tibet.
So tonight, back toward the forbidden city of Lhasa moves the caravan, where this newfound infant will be reared in a monastery, sleep between white satin sheets, eat from plates of gold, be taught the ritual of the Buddhist religion, and inherit a vast hoard of treasure, stored for centuries. Gifts of jewels from Buddhists throughout Tibet, Mongolia, China. Until his 18th year, a regency will rule. Then he will take over temporal power in Tibet, and Buddhistic spiritual power even greater than that of the Pope over the Catholic Church. A power he will wield throughout his life over the millions of Lamaist Buddhists who populate inner China from the Himalayas to Siberia. Time marches on. Today in Cincinnati, Ohio, says J.H. Finneybrock,
in depression, people drink less and eat less. Living temperately and carefully, they avoid accidents and diseases of excess. In good times, deaths from these causes rise, for people live more carelessly. Better times of the past year, gentlemen, have, as you might expect, substantially increased the nation's death rate.
With this report from their president, back to their homes go convention delegates of the Ohio Funeral Directors Association. Sure, they are following U.S. business out of depression. Today, throughout the U.S., following lurid disclosures of a new and hitherto obscure nightshirt organization known as the Black Legion, accused of executing Detroit WPA worker Charles Poole, comes a growing storm of controversy over Black Legion activity. In Washington, says New York's Representative Dick Stein,
I demand a full congressional investigation of this sinister and terroristic society known as the Black Legion.
In Lima, Ohio, says high Black Legion functionaire Vern Effinger,
the Black Legion has 6 million members all over the country, and we're going right on doing what we think is best for America. The biggest trouble with this country is we're cursed with too much liberty.
And in his prison cell in Detroit, says the accused slayer of Charles Poole, Black Legionnaire Dayton Dean.
Killing Poole was a horrible mistake. We were just following the orders of our superiors. We'd been told that Poole beat his wife almost to death just before she was going to have a baby. It was all a pack of lies.
As the 12 accused legionnaires are arraigned today for a preliminary hearing, from Ohio farmer William M. Smith comes a new point of view on Black Legion terrorism. To wide-eyed news hawks, farmer Smith unconcernedly relates a personal experience.
One night, a friend of mine asked me to go to a meeting out on a farm about 15 miles away. When we got out there, there was a bunch of fellas all dressed up in black gowns with them black hats on their heads. And a fellow that I knew came over and stuck a gun in my rib. He looked me all over.
Ray Krupp, what's your name?
You know what my name is. Hey, what is all this darn foolishness?
Be quiet. You're about to be initiated into a secret organization of the highest order. Eventually, we shall take over the government of the United States.
Well, if your society is such big stuff that you're going to take over the government, why do you have to meet out here on a farm in the middle of the night?
Because we're a band of outlaws.
Well, I ain't no outlaw, and I'm getting out of here.
All right, men, let him have it.
Let go of me. Let go of her.
Are you now prepared to join the Society of the Black Legion?
Hell no.
All right, we'll let you go. But if you ever tell what happened here tonight, you'll die within 24 hours.
Well, I told the officers all about it the very next day. A couple of days later, two of those Black Legion fellas come around to me and said I was going to die because I'd told. Shucks, that was 2 years ago. Ain't dead yet.
Today come reports of a scene enacted 1 month ago in the office of the world-famous Lloyd's Insurance Underwriters, where are convened a group of officials and members of the British Marstrand Fishing Company. One of the Lloyd's officials addresses them.
Now give us the facts, please, gentlemen.
Well, it's the strangest case in the Marstrand Company's history. On April 1st, our fishing trawler, the Girl Pat, set sail from Grimsby for its regular 2 week fishing trip to the North Sea Fields with Captain George Osborne and a crew of six.
Yes.
But instead of heading north on the North Sea fishing banks, the ship, for some unknown reason, turned south. Then they appeared at the port of Corcubion in Spain for repairs and supplies. They ordered the bill for £235 to be sent on to us. Then they set sail again.
And where's the ship right now?
Right now? We don't know. That's what we've come to you about.
The ship is insured with you, gentlemen, for £4,000.
Lloyd's is aware of our responsibility. We shall order every port and ship along the Atlantic to be on the lookout for her. We'll communicate with you the moment we get a clue.
Yesterday, quietly anchored at the port of Dakar in Senegal, French West Africa, is a snub-nosed fishing trawler, the words Girl Pat painted on her bow. On the deck stands Captain George Osborne, talking with a Senegalese dock official.
Captain Osborne, London has just notified us that you are not to leave this port without authority from them.
Who gave you those orders?
Lloyd's and the owners of this boat.
All right. Then I'll stay till they wire us further.
I have your word?
You have my word. You don't mind if I test your engines a bit, though?
If you do not go out of port. We have just received a storm warning and all vessels are staying in the harbor.
Right.
Oh, Stevens.
Yes, Captain.
Get full speed up as soon as possible. There's a heavy storm coming up, but we'll have to risk it. Full speed out to sea and keep sailing. Keep sailing.
And as the news of the Girl Pat's escape reaches public ears, all manner of rumors and reports pour into Lloyd's. From one man in Grimsby, England.
I'm a friend of Captain Osborne's. He said to me the day before he set sail, "Goodbye, you'll never see us again. If we get back to England from the place we're going, it won't be for 7 years.
From an Englishwoman living in Dakar, Senegal.
From the cabins of the Girl Pat, I heard raucous feminine and laughter. I know what they're doing. They've converted the ship into a love nest and are sailing the seas in a wave of unbridled debauchery.
From a lone old English mariner.
I know where they're going. They're headed south at a little island 180 miles from Madeira. There in a secret cove is hidden the biggest gold hoard in the world. I give them the maps and the charts, and I don't blame them for not telling anybody about it. If they find the gold, they're entitled to it themselves.
And late today, as a final enigmatic clue in the mystery, from the trawler Girl Pat herself, an amateur wireless operator deciphers a message.
We are somewhere in the Atlantic. We are honest, peaceful men and are now free. Signed, George Osborne. Captain, the Girl Pat.
Time marches on.
While listening to The March of Time, the reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the world, prepared and presented by the editors of Time.
Time marches on, and at ever-increasing speed. How many of us driving cars are forever pushing, pressing, trying to beat the light? Well, buy a package of Wrigley's Spearmint Gum and keep it handy. And the next time the light goes red, unwrap a stick and enjoy it. Really do this and convince yourself.
Again tomorrow night at this same hour, and every night, Monday through Friday, the March of Time.
Time marches on. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System. WABC, New York.